Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Solutions for the Next Generation of Software-Defined Radios. I'm Kurt Schwader, Technical Editor at Open Systems Media, and today's moderator with our speakers John Patchen from LinuxWorks, Charles Rush from OIS, and Steve Bernier from CRC. Today's total briefing is scheduled for about 50 minutes, leaving 10 at the end for a Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some important features of your audience console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fit your entire screen. Clicking the Download Slides button will allow you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box and associated Submit Question button allows you to participate in today's eCast. Simply type your question into the text box and submit it by clicking the button. You can submit questions at any time, and we'll do our best to address them during the closing Q&A. If you have a question or problem pertaining to the eCast operation itself, submit it, and one of our technicians will be happy to respond to you during the eCast. Finally, this eCast will be posted online within 24 hours, and an audio podcast will also be made available. More details on this at the end of the presentations. First-generation software-defined radio technology has been successfully deployed based on the JTRS Service Component Architecture, or SCA, but challenges still exist in terms of supporting SDR technology in smaller form factors with increasing algorithmic applications. But the challenge doesn't start or stop with the radio application itself. It's critical that the system software and development framework components take full advantage of new processor architectures and enable faster development of higher performance radio application software. Today we'll be hearing from LinuxWorks, OIS, and CRC about a fully integrated and off-the-shelf software package that enables next generation of software development defined radio development while still maintaining backwards compatibility. Our first speaker is John Patchen, Systems Engineering Manager at LinuxWorks. John is a graduate of the University of Kansas with degrees in mechanical engineering. He currently manages pre-sales engineering operations for LinuxWorks' range of real-time embedded operating systems. John, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kurt. Today we'll get started off with a LinkSOS SE from LinuxWorks. This is the medium assurance RTOS from LinuxWorks, and I'll be going into its capabilities and features in subsequent slides. So what is LinkSOS SE? First and foremost, it is a standalone operating system that has been security enhanced with time and space partitioning according to the ARINC 653-1 standard. It is also hard real-time and deterministic, so it can meet the requirements for a deterministic type application. LinkSOS SE also offers a very open standards Unix-like operating environment. It is very similar to Unix, and applications written on top of LinkSOS SE follow the Unix process and threads model. They can make system calls and use device drivers. LinkSOS SE can support shells and either serial port for the developer to interact with the system, the target machine. It can also support shells over Telnet or OpenSSH or some other secure connection. The POSIX conformant application programming interfaces of LinkSOS SE are conformant to POSIX 1003-13 profile PSC 53. This is the dedicated real-time system profile. It also supports a number of services from the PSC 54 profile. These are all listed in the documentation. LinkSOS SE is a very mature and stable operating system. It is based off LinuxWorks LinkSOS RTOS. LinkSOS has been around since the late 1980s, and it has been rigorously exercised through millions of lines of application code in many deployments over the past 20-plus years. LinkSOS SE supports hard partitioning of time, memory, and resources. This partitioning is time and space partition via, again, the ARINC 653-1 specification. So Linksys SE, in support of ARINC 63-1, implements a time-slicing scheduling algorithm to schedule each partition. This guarantees each partition a fixed execution limit or time in the system, which will isolate any faults to a single partition. So if a process in a partition A gets a fatal fault, the other processes in the remaining partitions are unaffected. The Linksys SE continues its open standards interfaces with the support of the ARINC 63-1 APEX API. This ensures application portability and software reuse, and allows interoperability between many embedded systems. And finally, with ARINC 653-1, Linksys SE offers health monitoring type services. So there is basically limitless possibilities for fault detection and fault recovery within an executing Linksys SE environment. Linksys SE supports brick wall partitioning, again, to highlight this ARINC 63-1 partitioning support. The brick wall partitioning pertains to time, memory, and resources. The partitions are scheduled using this fixed cyclic type ARINC 63-based interpartitioning scheduler. In addition, when a partition is executing, the threads within that partition are scheduled according to a priority preemptive intra-partition scheduler. So this priority preemptive intra-partition scheduling is fully, you know, real-time conformant. It guarantees that the highest priority thread ready to run within a partition will execute the instant it is ready to execute. The brick wall partitioning is further carried on to memory. There's a fixed allocation of physical memory per partition. This per-partition memory is enforced by the MMU hardware on the system, and is very rigorously implemented, so it has been, it would be easy to take through an evaluation or a certification. There's also a dynamic allocation of per-process memory within a partition. Each process within a partition executes in its own physical address space. Again, that process memory is enforced by the MMU. This memory is dynamically allocatable, though, at runtime. The process or threads within the process can dynamically allocate memory, and the process has view then of process virtual memory. So each process has up to 4 gigabytes of virtual address space. And finally, the brick wall partitioning pertains to resources, devices, and other I.O. Can be assigned to a specific partition. If there is a fault with that resource, the fault will be contained to the process that owns that resource or the partition that owns that resource. It is also possible to implement a partition-aware device driver. However, the reentrancy of the device driver would have to be implemented by the device driver writer themselves. The next slide is an architectural overview of the Linksys SE environment. The dotted line through the screen represents the separation of user space and kernel mode. Above the dotted line, we have user space. Below is the kernel. You'll notice in user space the brick walls. These brick wall partitions are only relegated to user space. So anything executing in the kernel is outside of the brick wall partitioning. Therefore, there are certain requirements placed on a device driver writers as far as how the ISR is executed, etc. These are all clearly documented in the documentation. However, up in user space, everything is protected by the brick wall partitions. You'll see we've got N represented partitions in this example. In partition 0, we have a few special processes. The first is the CINIT process, or the common init process. This is the first process that executes when the system comes up. The CNET process is responsible for reading the configuration of the system from the virtual machine configuration table, or VCT. You'll see the VCT represented by the purple box just below the dotted line on the far right. After reading the information from the VCT, CNET will build each of the other remaining partitions. That includes allocating the memory, setting up the fixed-time cyclic-based scheduler, and also allocating the I/O resources. When each partition starts, the first process to run within that partition is called the PNIT process. The PNIT process will be responsible for forking and launching other processes within that partition. Additionally, each partition can have its own RAM-based file system. This is a read and writable file system. They can also share file systems on other persistent storage devices, for instance, flash devices. The only requirement or the only restriction there is only one partition can have both read and write access. The remaining partitions have read access only. Linksys SE supports both dynamic and static device drivers. Static device drivers are linked in with the kernel and are automatically installed at kernel boot time. Dynamic device drivers can reside on the file system and be installed dynamically after the kernel is booted. You'll see full TCP/IP stack functionality and file system support is also available. Features of Linksys SE. Linksys SE for this particular application, we're highlighting the ARM Cortex-A8 BSP. This is a BSP that we support out of the box and is already in use in a variety of different handheld software-defined radio applications. We also offer BSPs for Linksys SE on x86 and PowerPC. The file system support is a full POSIX-compliant file system. It supports access control based on POSIX file attributes. And it is inode based, so it's very similar to Linux ext2 file system. In addition, this file system can reside in flash or some other persistent storage, or it can also be RAM based. There is also a journaling flash file system that is available, part of the standard product, that if fault tolerance and journaling capabilities are a requirement for the application, the journaling flash file system is available. Networking support, the TCP/IP stack within the Linksys SE kernel is very full-featured. It's based off the FreeBSD 4 stack, and it supports IPv4 and IPv6 as standard. It also includes a lot of other Internet protocols, including Kerberos for NFS4, NFS, NTP, quality of service, and some security functionality via IPsec and the PF packet filter functions. In addition to the brick wall partitioning, Linksys SE offers a variety of other security functionality. The security functionality, the general features are listed here. I'll go into a little bit more detail. For discretionary access control, this is implemented via access control lists. The traditional POSIX process or permission model for files on a file system include the owner, user, and group, where each class defined a permission to read, write, or execute operations on a given file. Permissions can also be assigned to an object, for instance, a device in the slash dev directory, so it can restrict access to a device based on the owner or the current user on the system. Linksys SE takes that one step further via access control lists. Access control lists provide very fine-grained access control to files on the file system. With access control lists, access rights on a file can be specified for a specific user ID or a specific group ID. So it is possible to to very tightly define who has access to a file on the Linksys SE file system. Linksys SE also supports auditing with fine-grained event auditing. With auditing, events like login, logout, object access, and administrative tasks can be logged to an audit trail. The audit trail contains invaluable information that can be used to review security critical events, discover attempts to bypass security mechanisms, track usage of privileges by users, provide a deterrent against attempted attacks since the auditing logging captures the intrusion attempts, and also for performing forensic analysis. Linksys SE supports roles and capabilities. Like all Unix system, there is the root user, and the all-encompassing privileges of root make it susceptible to abuse, whether it's unintended or intentional. The problem is resolved by Linksys SE by decomposing root into a fine set of fine-grained privileges. So when the user logs in, when the root user logs into Linksys SE, they also must log in as a role for the root user. Linksys SE supports cryptography via the OpenSSL protocol, provides support for quotas. The quotas in Linksys SE can be assigned to disk, CPU, and memory resources. Disk quotas will specify the maximum number of disk blocks and inodes that file owned by a user group can use at any point in time. Disk quotas are per file system or per disk partition. Memory quotas specify how much physical memory a user can use at any point in time within a VM. The memory usage of a user is a sum of all the memory usages of the process of that user. And finally, CPU quotas specify the CPU time, and this is a hard limit, that the user can use over a specific period of time within a VM. Once a process approaches that specified time, it will receive a signal and shut down. And finally, there's self-testing, residual information protection, and trusted path login. The next two slides are screenshots of the tool. The Linksys SE supports the Luminosity IDE, which is Eclipse-based. And this within Luminosity, you can define kernels, build kernels, applications, debug and build, and along with device drivers. And finally, the last tool is Spiker, which is our software logic analyzer. It's a trace and visualization tool that can be used to view events like resource contention, bottlenecks, deadlocks, and critical process timings. And that does it for my slide, so I will turn it back over to you, Kurt.
Thank you, John. Our next speaker is Charles Rush, Senior Vice President of Software Engineering at OIS. A graduate of the Naval Academy and former naval aviator, Charles currently leads the Middleware Technologies Group in developing and enhancing the Orb Express product family. Charles?
Thank you, Kurt, and thank you for joining me today. As Kurt said, I'm Charles Rush, Senior Vice President of Middleware Technology, and I'd like to talk a little bit about Orb Express and how you can use Orb Express as a tool to help you overcome the issues as you take the SAA into smaller and smaller form factors. Orb Express is an implementation of the OMG's real-time CORBA specification, and the SEA specifies CORBA currently as the inter-process communication framework, and Orb Express is used widely amongst the current implementations of SDR radios today. And the importance of it is that using these sorts of frameworks and tools can reduce radio development cost and can increase portability of the tools that you're using today, and as you move from one environment to another environment. It also enables distributed processing, and it's an open standard, which is widely supported. The challenges for smaller and smaller form factor radios today stem from a couple of issues. The technical, size, weight, and power, that's what you're trying to overcome, those are limitations. Until we reach zero weight, zero power consumption, and zero size, there's always more work to be done and things to be looked at. Latency of the message set is a big driver as you try to move from one part of an application to another part of the application, you want to move your data across. And it's the latency that it begins to be the bottleneck to where you need to add more and more power. Coupled to this are the realities of the microchip processor vendors, depending on what you have available as you look forward chips and try to bring these systems together from an integration standpoint. Obsolescence creates one set of problems. Newer chips that are focused on different markets present another problem. And these come into the business aspects where, as we see reduced R&D funding more and more in the world, you've got to do more with less, faster, and better. So what I'd like to focus on, since we're middleware vendors, is the latency that happens during the communication. And for the purpose of my discussion, I want to define latency as the time you're going to take to move data from one function to the next function, because this is where the work's being done. So we have a typical system, block architecture, not SCA, not anything in particular. You have an application. Inside that application process, it's got some threads. It's running on top of an operating system, network stack, POSIX library. You've got kernel operations. So we want to talk about where latency can be introduced as you move data from one spot to another. The fastest way to move data is if you stay inside a single thread of execution, and then you make a function call from do to bar, and you're going to move some data along. And that's as fast a data transfer as you can do. It's also single-threaded. It's quick. It's easy. The next thing that you might want to do is move data between two different threads if you're going to read or post a queue or something. This now introduces the latency associated with context switch. So you want to minimize the number of context switch as you go between threads, because every context switch you need creates latency. So unnecessary context switches should be avoided. Then the other thing you might need to do as you're moving data across is to prep the data in terms of doing some kind of transformation. It's possible that to transmit it, you've got it in native format. You need to flip it to an Indian for the next receiver to read, or you might need to pad it, go from Celsius to Fahrenheit, change your longitude, your latitude from minutes to decimal degrees, decimal seconds, things like that. And then that kind of effort is just data transformation. And since we're on small and constrained systems, it's important to minimize the number of unnecessary calls and executions you want. So you're always looking for efficiency and reuse everywhere along the path. Then after that, you now need to do some kind of IPC. You want to move data out of this process, which created and collected it and maybe did some processing on it, into another one. Now you're going to introduce some kind of IPC mechanism that is generally presented to you and or operating system specifics. Shared memory comes to mind, Unix sockets. There's any number of them. There's various backplane specific ones. They're all out there. What they all have in common is at some point you're trapping into the kernel, you're doing something, and you're coming back out. Again, this is adding some additional latency. Latency that you have to have, and you've got to encounter it, but again, it's the efficiency everywhere here, and you want to be measuring and understanding which one's faster and which one's slower. Then the next thing that's going to bring some time to you is if you want to get out of that application space and that address space on that process down into another box somewhere else on your network, now you're going to introduce the network latencies, network communication. It doesn't matter whether you're doing TCP/IP, Raceway, whatever. Every one of these network communications has their own overhead associated with them that you need to use. So this is the latency that you're inducing of reading and writing into the transport buffer, whatever's necessary, how many copies. And it all depends on whichever one you're going to use. And after that, you actually get down to the physical layer. And this is where if for one network communication versus the same network communication on improved physical hardware, you can get some speed improvements. 10 megabit Ethernet was much slower than the current today's 1 gigabit. But switching from 10 meg to 1 gig doesn't change the application, so that reduces latency, and it's generally a good thing to do. So now that's all the areas where latency can occur. I'm going to take you a quick walk through a typical SCA hardware, you know, block diagram, and then we'll look where within the SCA latencies can occur. You've got hardware, and the hardware runs on a particular bus. Then you need a POSIX-compliant operating system, as Lynx SE, as we just heard about, is. And that brings you POSIX, your network drivers, and things like that. And then inside that, you load what's called a core framework. This is an application that launches other applications. It is the essence of the component architecture portion of the software communication architecture, and Steve Vernier from CRC will talk in a little bit more about the role a core framework plays. And once you have a core framework together and an operating system, you've got a what is referred to as an operating environment. Now, within this operating environment, you can then launch SCA applications. And these SCA applications form all – you can have one or more that form a the waveform itself. You can also spawn these applications on different processors with different components, depending on the way you want to separate your application for security, safety, different processing loads, depending on how many processors you want to bring in. These are all the variations that come to play. The next thing, you can also, as I said, on one processor, you might have multiple applications. Now, as you move the data around within the SCA, still the fastest data movement is within functions on a single thread of execution. Lowest latency possible, doesn't introduce any latency. The next thing is the context switch. You're still moving data on the same thing within the same context switch. You really haven't involved or invoked any additional latency yet from going down to the network. IPC mechanisms still come into play as you move between processes in between. But then again, still the worst case is when you want to come out of one thread all the way down, hit a network barrier, come back up, and then into another thread of execution. Now, what we take from all this is that if you want to minimize the end-to-end latency introduced from communication, is that you need to minimize crossing the boundaries, whether you're crossing thread boundaries, process boundaries, processor boundaries. Every one of these crossings, regardless of your architecture, introduce latency. Now, within Orb Express, we've done everything we can to optimize those latency. And there's various things that both Orb Express can provide for you. One of the first is that if you're in a thread of execution from one function call to the next, you're still not even doing anything. If the next thing you did between those two functions were in two different CORBA calls in two different CORBA objects, Orb Express knows that when you make the call, and we do a local optimization that jumps from one object direct to the other at the speed of a function call. This enables you to not have any of the overhead of going down of any marshalling or anything like that. The next thing we do for you is that data translation optimizations, Orb Express, is optimized to move data in and out of the Orb space as fast as possible. We call this data marshalling. Our marshalling has been benchmarked, and it's been found to be very fast, and we make this very efficient for you. And again, the benefit of CORBA, you don't have to flip the Indian if you're moving across in location transparency. The other thing the Orb is doing is handling whether that object is local for you or remote, and you don't need to program for that. Then the next big thing that of latency happens is when we write into the transport and go down into the layers. Orb Express provides a pluggable transport API. So you can do two things. You can switch the fastest transport possible. You don't have to be using TCP. You can use a different proprietary backplane that you may have, and it doesn't disturb any application code. Application code becomes unaware of the performance increase from switching transports. The other thing that writing your own transport allows you to do certain things inside the transport layer that may be application specific. It's abstracted away from the application, but you can now do certain things that help your application, might be some monitoring or logging, et cetera. Orb Express is also multi-threaded. So on the server side, you can have multiple CORBA objects that increase the parallelization as the calls are upcoming on the other side. And since Orb Express is multi-threaded, That now brings us to multi-core. Multi-core is the next thing coming into the embedded marketplace on the chips. You're seeing it in multi-core items. You're seeing it in multi-core ARMs. You're seeing it in multi-core power PCs. Multi-cores are good because they allow you to generally execute more instructions per second for the same or less power consumption. They don't necessarily force you to cross a boundary. So this parallel execution without boundary crossing is a real improvement in terms of power and your capability to get more work done per unit of time. But your ability to exploit multi-core application is dependent on your architecture and your tools. If your architecture is already single-threaded architecture, you've only got one thread of execution, no latency introduced, but you can't do two threads at once. If you're using a tool that is already ready to spread multiple threads like Orb Express, then you're going to be easier to move your application to take advantage of the extra cores so they're not just sucking power from you. The other thing that's important is your understanding and your tool's understanding of the critical sections of code, whether they're being protected or not and how they're going to be protected, and that you're not inducing additional latency by calling things out of the kernel that necessarily aren't. So Orb Express is multi-threaded. It enables you to move to it without much more work. That's all I've got for today. I'd like to thank you for your time, and Kurt, up to you.
Very good. Thanks, Charles. Today's final speaker is Steve Bernier, Research Manager at the Communications Research Center, Canada, where he leads the Advanced Radio Systems Group. His group is focused on providing solutions to help industry with the development of SCA software-defined radios. Steve joined CRC in 1999 and became a lead architect for the CRC Software Communications Architecture products. A recognized thought leader, Steve and his team have made several key contributions to the SCA specification. The CRC team received the Wireless Innovation Forum's International Achievement Award for its contributions to SDR and the SCA. Steve holds a bachelor's and master's degree from computer science from the Université de Sherbrooke, Quebec, Canada. Steve?
Thank you. I'll start with what CRC offers. CRC is a research center in Canada, and we have, as Kurt was saying, been working on the SCA for many years. And what we have come up with over the years is something called the SCRE Software Suite. And that is a package of software that comes with a core framework, a modeling tool, and a runtime monitoring tool. And so the core framework that we offer is a full implementation of the SCA specification. It's the only commercial off-the-shelf core framework that has been deployed on real radios, battlefield. It's available for a very large selection of processors and operating systems, and it's also supported by a number of platform starter kits for SCA development, we also offer a modeling tool. I have some slides on that and about what it does, and a runtime monitoring tool as well, which allows you to connect to an SCA radio that's running and then allows you to see graphically what's running on in terms of the SCA components on a target platform. So let's start with the SCA core frameworks, and I'll just go quickly over what the goal of SCA core frameworks is, or the role of an SCA core framework. So the goal of the SCA spec is to allow applications to be quickly ported across radio platforms, and applications with an SCA platform, an SCA radio, the concept is such that you could add an application to a radio post-manufacturing, or that you can easily install a new application on an existing radio platform. And to do that, basically, the SCA relies on the use of a file system to store the application binaries, and it requires a loader to be able to use that file system and instantiate new binaries to basically put together or launch an application made of potentially several binary files. The core framework is responsible for handling the instantiation of applications. So it's the core framework responsibility to read from the file system, find out which binaries need to be launched for a specific application to be instantiated. And it does so by reading a number of standard XML files, and they're referred to as within the SCA world as domain profiles. The core framework finds basically a suitable target device where to deploy each of the binaries, and the deployment, the concept of a deployment of the application as far as the core framework is concerned, is a process that involves transferring binary files from some storage memory to some runtime memory, because the SCA has been designed has been designed for distributed systems or multi-processor platforms, and the SCA doesn't assume that everything as far as the software is concerned is running on a single processor. Then the core framework is basically responsible for making sure that the right binary is sent to the right processor for the instantiation of an application. And so in a way, the SCA core framework is very file intensive, and the deployment for the core framework to be able to do the deployment or to perform the deployment of an application, one thing it needs to be aware of is all of the devices that are in or part of an SCA platform. And so it needs to know that it has a number of processors, not just the one GPP, but maybe a couple processors, DSPs and FPGAs and stuff like that. And as part of the SCA way of doing or SCA philosophy, the components, the hardware components, are always represented as software components called SCA devices. And the boot time of an SCA radio platform involves launching all the SCA devices that are essentially proxies to the hardware components within the radio platform. And those software proxies, the SCA devices, they register with this one central component of the SCA core framework called the domain manager. And again, when that happens, the domain manager essentially learns dynamically by reading descriptors of all the SCA devices. It learns dynamically what the SCA devices are capable of and what they can be used for. And every time you launch or start your radio, this process of reading the XML files and figuring out which devices are available happens, and that's part of the boot time. So in short, SCA core frameworks are very file-centric, and if there's one thing you need to remember from this presentation is that the speed of the file system is crucial, is paramount in making the boot times as short as possible. So now the scary core framework from CRC, the fifth generation of a core framework, so this is called Scary GT, is our latest core framework. It was built from the ground up for embedded systems. It's a core framework that builds on the previous generation and contains years of feedback and real deployment experience. It runs on a wide range of platforms, it comes with everything you need to do your development for an SCA platform. So it comes with a number of components. You know, those of you familiar with the SCA will recognize core components like the domain manager, the application factory, the application object, device manager, file system, file, log services and devices. It comes with a number of example starting examples of SCA components like the executable device or an audio device. It comes with a couple demonstration applications as well that have been developed using our tools and that run on our core framework. The core framework, the GT core framework, the most recent one, implements a number of performance optimizations, and they fall into essentially two categories. The optimizations either allow you to make things smaller in terms of footprint, or allow you to reduce the boot time and in a way make communications between components faster with lower latencies. And that lower latency issue here, it ties back with the presentation from Charles Ruff from OIS just prior to mine here, and I'll get back to how we are able to support or support this feature through the GT Core framework. The GT Core framework, and basically the next few slides, I'll go through a couple key features that the GT Core framework comes with, and I'll have some data to show. I can't see right now on the slide the graph or the table that I have. Maybe just give me 1 second here it is. Okay. Back on track. Okay, so one of the pretty important features that the GT Core framework comes with is acceleration of local file access. And so basically, if you look at all the instructions or all the tasks that a core framework must implement or must execute for a platform to boot, a number of them involve reading files or copying files around. And basically, if you are in a position, as far as the core framework is concerned, to determine that some of those file access are actually local, they are not remote, and instead of going through, at that point, through the normal distributed system way of accessing the files, you can actually take a shortcut and read files locally or natively instead. Get a chance or you get a significant improvement in most cases. And I have two examples of, I guess, the extreme cases. At one end of the spectrum, we have a single core, but a 3 gigahertz Pentium. And it's not in this configuration. We're not relying on the network file system. We're using the native file system, which is the ideal situation in terms of performance. And this test scenario here is we take a 4 megabyte file and copy that file. And there's the time without acceleration is around 355 milliseconds, but with the acceleration, only 20 for a pretty good improvement. Now, of course, this is just it's 94%, but it still just adds up to a couple or a few hundred milliseconds, and you need a lot of those to make a boot time much faster. But if you look at the other end of the spectrum, the same feature becomes a lot more significant in terms of seconds, in terms of boot time. So for a PowerPC 405 using NFS, you go from for a 1.5 meg file that is being copied, you go from 2.5 seconds to 1.5 seconds. And since there are a number of files that need to be copied and read, that 1 second improvement can be obtained several times for one single boot time. And then, you know, those seconds starts to add up to a much faster boot up sequence. There's also a feature where we use a caching, a file caching system for the deployed components, and this, in some cases, is a good solution, and it helps reduce the boot time. And essentially, this is a feature by which if the application, if your radio platform is a manpack, and that manpack will always have the same devices and will always deploy the same application the same way, you might wonder, you know, why am I going through the same process of copying files around and copying them from the same place to the same place every time the boot up scenario happens? So if there was a way to actually take a snapshot of the runtime configuration and start back from that snapshot, when possible, then a lot of time could be saved, and that's what this feature does here. Then there's also, you know, other features like optimization of connections. So if you have an assembly of components, several components interconnected through ports and connections, and those same ports are involved in several connections, and you have, you know, not just a few tens of connections, but sometimes above 100, almost 200 connections. There's a feature in Scary GT that actually caches and does an analysis of the connections and caches the ports or the information gathering needed to establish the connection, and that significantly improves the time it takes to do connections, and that translates into faster boot time. Because there's a number of connections that need to happen before the radio actually is not only up and running, but, you know, operational. And that's one of the features that GT comes with. The Scary GT Core framework also has a pretty interesting feature called massive registration, or an optimization of the registration for device managers. This is an extended feature of this core framework. It means that it's a feature that if the Scary GT core framework, meaning the domain manager and device manager, are used together, they basically know about this extended way of doing registration and will use it if the domain manager is actually a standard domain manager, then the Scary GT device manager falls back to normal registration, and vice versa for the domain manager being the GT and the device manager being a standard one, you get back to normal registration. But if both have that feature and they detect it, then they can minimize significantly the boot time by doing basically a pre-hash, or we can call it a digest, providing a digested set of information from the device manager to the domain manager. And this helps avoid several files from being copied and reread. In terms of improvement you're looking at, I have two scenarios here. Linux desktop with one device, Linux desktop with four devices booting at the power-up time. And then I have a Lynx OS with a PowerPC. The Linux desktop is actually the same Pentium processor we were talking about, a 3 gigahertz Pentium. And then we have a scenario where I'm using LinkSOS with a PowerPC 405 with one device and four devices. And you can look at standard registration time for the first test is half a second. And if you do it with the one call registration, then you save 60%. But the savings add up as you have more devices. It's actually almost an exponential saving. If you have four devices, it's only 1.5 second for registration. But you look at the one call registration, and you basically just added a few milliseconds to the registration time. And the case is even better when you go on smaller processors for smaller platforms. You go from 0.8 seconds to 0.1 second for one device, but you do that times four for four devices, and you're still just at 0.2 seconds for the registration time. And registration time means the domain manager knows everything it needs to know about the device manager and the devices and services that have been launched by that device manager. And that quickly adds up to much faster boot times on a small platform. I think I hit next twice. No, okay. So one of the other features that the core framework supports is standalone SCA devices. And if I just speed through this here, basically it's a feature by which you can have several SCA devices and services built into a single address space that report to the Scary GT device manager. The Scary GT device manager then goes to report to the domain manager in a standard way. But by providing this capability of having several devices and services into a single address space, you actually save tremendously on footprint if you're using static linking environments. You don't save as much if you're using a shared library environment, but in both cases, where you save a lot is in terms of latencies or speed of communication between the devices, and that's back to the presentation from OIS earlier. This means that the several SCA components are actually running within a single address space, and they can benefit from direct function invocation between them, between the individual SCA devices that are running in the same address space. And I make a reference to a paper that was published in 2005 where ISR Technologies, a company based in Montreal, had used this feature to save tremendously or improve their transport latencies on one of their system. And it actually made a big difference for their system as it did for a number of other systems as well. Then one other thing you can get with the GT Core framework is that you actually get a choice of running the domain manager in a separate address space from the device manager, or running both of them in the same address space. And for static linking environments, that represents nearly 50% footprint savings. And in terms of memory savings for small platforms, that actually adds up and counts. The other thing the Core framework supports, is since it's a full implementation of all the features of an SCA Core framework, it supports the resource factory concept or feature. And this allows an application, a number of application components, to be co-located or launched in a single address space. And for the same reasons I stated on the previous slide for SCA devices, this is a very important feature because you can save in terms of footprint, but you can also save in terms of speed of communication or lower latencies of communication between the different components of an SCA application. And I make a reference to another paper, the a paper published in 2009, where we provide lots of metrics about the differences between single address space, multiple address space, single core processor, multi-core processors, and so on, so that you could get better data. I'm running a little behind here, so I'll skip the last slide, but I'll just summarize it to say that on features, optimization features for the Core framework, that this Core framework comes with a handcrafted XML parser, which is blazing fast and uses only a fraction of the memory compared to when a commercial off-the-shelf XML parser is used. The second piece of the puzzle here is SCA Architect. SCA Architect is a modeling tool that allows developers to go create models, graphical models of their SCA components or the assemblies of components they need to put together. And then the tool, SCA Architect, is used to be able to generate C++ source code for all kinds of components, build artifacts, the XML standard domain profiles. It also is used to, it can be used to import XML domain profiles and validate them and so on. Just a quick overview here of the fact that when you create an application, an SCA application, you basically have to do that from a bunch of binaries or executable for some components of your application and the standard XML domain profiles. And how do you get that? Well, you get the binaries because from using an IDE, a compiler linker from source code. That source code can be handwritten, or you can actually use a modeling tool to generate that source code and from models. And you can actually use that same modeling tool, in this case SCA Architect, to combine together the binaries and the proper XML files to create a package called an SCA application that you can then go to any Core framework, standard Core framework, and install that generated application for you. This is just a simple screenshot of what it looks like. So basically, SCA Architect is an Eclipse plugin. On the left-hand side, you have a Project Explorer where you have all of the parts of your project, so anything you're modeling, the modeling elements, the ports, the properties, the components, the applications, And on the right-hand side, you have an editor for every type of modeling element. So in this case here, it's a component with three ports, also three properties. And at the bottom, you get a bunch of you have a problems view where you get messages for fixing XML that you imported or to help you go and generate source code for this component that you're modeling. And in this case here, you see what an assembly looks like in the modeling tool. So it's a number of components interconnected via ports, and this diagram or this model is used to generate the proper SCA XML files. And then the final piece is just a radio manager. So it's a monitoring tool. It shows a hierarchical view of the components running on a target SCA radio. It's used to install applications, start application, configure, and see log messages and events being generated by the SCA platform. This is a screenshot of what this tool looks like. It works with any core framework, but if it's used with the SCA, the scary GT core framework, then it knows about a couple extra features and it gathers more information from the framework to be able to offer a better and more precise graphical representation of what's running inside the SCA platform. And this is my last slide. Back to you, Kurt.
Thank you very much. We'll quickly get some Q&A here. There is a question here for John, I believe, with operating system. You talked about the brick wall between processes, and this person would like to know if there's any other, what kind of communication methods there are between processes through this brick wall. Is shared memory allowed, pipes, and other things available to do that?
Okay, thank you, Kurt. Actually, there's two forms of inter-process communication within Linksys SC. The first is within a single partition or intra-partition. Within a partition, you can use the ARINC 653-1 inter-process communications. Those would be blackboards for shared memory, et cetera. So there's a variety of possibilities through ARINC. And there's also the POSIX shared memory, message queues, pipes, any of the other POSIX possibilities. For inter-partition, or between two processes in different partitions, there are the ARINC 653 message ports and sampling ports and queuing ports. So those are the APIs for inter-process communication between two partitions.
Good. This person has a legacy situation where they have some open source CORBA. I guess this is for Charles. How does the Orb Express product integrate with their legacy system, or how hard is it to port over to Orb Express?
It shouldn't be very hard at all. If the legacy application is using all the open standard APIs that OMG specified, all Orbs tend to support those, so changing from one tool to the next should be pretty straightforward. I also want to tag on to what John was talking about, the ARINC queuing imports. On the LinksOS SE system, Orb Express has got transport supporting the ARINC queue, so you can do the inter-process communication that way without CORBA, without having to dig down into that level. Thanks.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Here's a question for Steve. Does SCA define any interfaces between radio application files, or must these application files that you talked about operate independently from one another?
It does and it doesn't. At one level, the JTRS program does provide a bunch of standard APIs for SCA devices to implement or for SCA applications to use, but there isn't a whole lot of APIs, standard APIs anyways, for communications between applications. Now, if you mean one application sending data to another application, then there are APIs that are standard for exchanging data between components, and that could work. But in the most part, the standard APIs are between the SCA application and SCA devices or SCA services being used by the SCA applications.
Okay, I see. Question for Charles here about SCA and Orbs. they've typically thought of this as a communication backplane or network kind of interface. How well does the ORB stuff scale down into multiple processes on a single board or multiple cores within a single processor? I think you've touched on that in your presentation, but maybe you can elaborate a little bit.
It scales down very well because you're crossing the boundaries, as I was talking about. The fact that Qorba was designed for distributed, cross-enterprise, you're still crossing a boundary, and it's about the location transparency.
Right.
If you move your Qorba objects local, you don't have any of the overhead associated from going through it. It's just a quick function call. But as you start moving them around, you can move them from the thread local to the next process, to the next machine across the world, and the application code didn't change. You just introduced the latencies of the speed of light going from here to 22,000 satellite and back down.
I see. Okay, John, how about your dynamic driver support you talked about, and you talked about can that update existing device drivers, or is dynamic driver support update just to put new drivers into a running system?
It can actually be used to replace an existing running driver. So you would simply, from your application, uninstall the dynamic driver. And then once a driver is dynamically uninstalled, its system resources are automatically freed. And then you would reinstall it could be a different driver, it could be the same driver, et cetera, something that resides in the file system.
Okay.
To be dynamically installed.
All right. Unfortunately, I think we've run over time a little bit, and that's the time we have for our question and answer. I'm sorry if we didn't get to your questions, but feel free to communicate with the presenters or their companies directly if we did not get to your questions. I'd really appreciate and thank you all for attending today's eCast, and thank you guys for taking the time to be with us and share some important insights in the world of software-defined radios. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen, and an audio-only podcast version will also be made available. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all Open Systems Media eCasts available for download as MP3s. Thank you all for attending, and have a great day.